Unseen Diversity, Lecture 2, Hidden in Plain Sight, Part 1.
So we left the previous lecture with me beginning to explain what I mean when I say that we really cannot consider bacteria to be on a smooth continuum or a smooth spectrum of very large organisms to large organisms to medium-sized organisms to small to the tiny to the very tiniest, which are the bacteria, that it's not actually a simple continuum. Bacteria are really quite different. They are not just tiny versions of large organisms, or perhaps the other way around. We are not necessarily large versions of those tiny organisms. I think of the continuum or the spectrum as a broken continuum. It's almost as if we're sliding along the continuum from large organisms to medium organisms to small-sized organisms, and suddenly we fall off the edge of a cliff and we're into a completely different world of the truly tiny organisms who are really doing things very, very differently. Here's another analogy that I think of mainly because I love dollhouses and I have dollhouses at home, and I sometimes think of the continuum of tiny things that you have in a dollhouse. In fact, you could even have a dollhouse within a dollhouse. One of the dollhouse children might have a dollhouse. So imagine all of the things in a regular house and then have them scale down to the size of what you might find in a doll's house, and then have a tiny doll's house within that doll's house, which in turn has tiny furniture. Scaling down on a relatively smooth continuum, and what I'm saying is you can't do that with bacteria. I say that you're scaling down and there comes to be a point where the continuum breaks and you're in a different world, a world where things are not simply smaller versions of whatever came higher in the continuum. That makes bacteria very intriguing, and it makes them a challenge. One of the many things that makes them a challenge, an interesting challenge, I think, for naturalists who want to incorporate them into their nature studies. So in the last lecture, we were in the middle of a series of broad generalizations about bacteria. I had told you that they were the most numerous. I had said that they were the most diverse of all organisms on Earth, and that they were the most ancient of all organisms on Earth. Continuing with those broad generalities, bacteria are also the most featureless of all organisms on Earth, especially from our human point of view, when we are so oriented to other organisms that have morphologies and colors and activities. So bacteria are featureless, and I will even go so far as to say they are disappointing. Not necessarily disappointing to me now, but they certainly were disappointing to me the first time I ever saw them as a future biologist, as an undergraduate in college. And if you have ever tried to see bacteria under the microscope, you might know exactly what I mean. Let me remind you or tell you what that first experience is typically like. You have a microscope. You put a slide with bacteria, presumably on it, although you cannot see those bacteria. And you set that slide under a microscope, and you put the lowest power lens on it. You see nothing. You merely try to focus as best you can on some debris. Then you put your next most powerful lens in place. Again, you see nothing. And then you put your next most powerful lens in place, and at this point, you're probably magnifying things 400 times. You probably see nothing. You focus a little bit. If you're in a classroom, your professor comes over and looks in. You say, "Is that it?" Piece of debris. "No, that's not it." Your professor focuses a little bit for you, and at 400x, you see tiny, tiny dots and dashes. Maybe if the lighting is just so, and if the focus has been done just so. And it's disappointing. That's your first view of bacteria. Perhaps you go to the next higher lens after that, which will magnify things 1,000 times, And they're still disappointing. They're still tiny dots and dashes. And in fact, they're like little bits of punctuation. You could take the, you know, top register of keys on your keyboard, which are mostly your punctuation marks, and you could put little squiggles and dashes of various sorts and use the comma and the period to make some more punctuation, and you'd end up with the full range of morphologies of bacterial shapes. There's not much to look at. So they're not about what they look like. They are about what they do. And that's one of the reasons for the drop in the continuum, the drop off the cliff into a completely different world. It's a world of doing and not a world of morphology. So it means that we have to understand bacteria from the point of view of what they're doing. Now, this next generality about them relates to that. Here's the generality that probably does not need to be said, or at least it will sound as though it doesn't need to be said. Bacteria are tiny. Do I need to say that? Yes, because tininess has its own profound connotations that I think we can only imagine, because we ourselves are nowhere near in the position of being able to directly experience what it must be like to be as tiny and therefore as intimate with the environment as bacteria are, because that's one of the major consequences of being tiny. Bacteria are in a very intimate relationship with their surrounding environment, so that any little nuance, any little change of acidity or alkalinity or temperature or salt or moisture levels, any input or output from a bacterium that's right next to them, because after all, their environment is not just the physical environment, but it's also the other bacteria that are in the environment. They have an immediate and nuanced response to that. They're very quick to respond to any changes whatsoever, and that has great connotations for their relationships with the physical world. It's all about those responses, and it's all about putting chemicals out into the environment, taking chemicals in, and being responsive to whatever is going on in the environment, mostly in respect to chemicals. In fact, sensing chemicals is their major sense. It's their primary sense. It's very little of any other kind of sense that is in the bacterial world. We, remember, we're anomalously large. We, anomalously large organisms, can only imagine what that might be like. And in fact, try this little thought experiment. If there were some sugar sprinkled out on the tabletop, and if you accidentally rested your hand in it, nothing would happen. Absolutely nothing. You might feel a little bit of granularity, but none of your skin cells would respond in any way whatsoever to that being sugar. They wouldn't taste it as sugar. They wouldn't smell it as sugar. They would not immediately leap into action and begin to digest that sugar for you. And it would be bizarre to think that they would. We are insulated from the environment for the most part compared to bacteria. And the only way that I can tell that that's sugar or sweet is to take it into my mouth and to have very specialized cells of mine taste them as sweet, taste the sugar granules as sweet. And the only way I can begin to digest it is to take that sugar in and put it into contact with very specific digestive cells. It's just one of the things about being multicellular and huge as we are. And it's a very, very different thing. The entire bacterium has these responses, hair trigger responses to whatever is going on in the environment. Another thing about being tiny is you can reproduce much, much more quickly. There's just less material to make a copy of, is maybe one way to think about it. And bacteria indeed do reproduce extremely quickly, so that their whole timeline is sped up in a way that, again, it's hard for us to understand. There are some bacteria that can make copies of themselves in an hour or less, and others along the order of hours to days. If a bacterium is not reproducing quickly, it's probably because it is dormant. There's not enough nutrients around, in which case it's waiting for nutrients to show up, in which case it will start reproducing again fairly quickly. So we are anomalously slow in our reproduction. We are not sensitive at all in the way that bacteria are to our immediate environment. And therefore, we need to understand these things about bacteria in order to really get a feeling for who they are and to start to recognize them in the environment. By the way, I keep calling ourselves anomalously large. We are even anomalously large in respect to our fellow animals. Try this little exercise. Most animals are not vertebrates like ourselves. They are invertebrates. The vast majority of animals are invertebrates. And by the way, probably marine invertebrates. So invertebrates that are completely beyond what our usual venue is. The vast majority of invertebrates are arthropods. Those are the jointed legged animals that include the spiders and the crabs and the insects. Vast majority of the invertebrates are arthropods. The vast majority of arthropods are insects, and most insects are beetles. And most beetles are tiny, tiny. So most of a major group of organisms, the beetles, are much, much tinier. We're the ones that are lumbering around in our terrestrial way, in our huge multicellular way, completely out of touch through most of ourselves with our environment. We're the ones that are anomalous in this. So again, the real challenge is to overcome that, at least mentally, and to try to see the world in a bacterial way. Right now, I would like to make a point about the way I've been using the word bacteria as a term. I have been using it in a colloquial way, although it might not have been obvious. One of the interesting recent developments of the last 20 years, especially since so much DNA sequence is now available for us to sort out organisms of all sorts. One of the really exciting developments in the last 20 years is that all of the organisms that we used to consider to be just the bacteria are now divided into two enormous groups. So one of these groups continues to be called the bacteria, and the other group gets called the archaea, A-R-C-H-A-E-A, the archaea. And I will tell you that the terminology for these two new groups is challenging, continues to be challenging. There have been a number of other ways of referring to them that have been tried out and essentially dropped for a little while. The bacteria were going to be called the eubacteria, that's E-U, eubacteria, and the archaea were going to be called the archaebacteria. And that seems to have not been favored recently. Right now, it's the bacteria and the archaea. We don't really have at this point a good unifying name that is accepted by microbiologists everywhere for what we would call the bacteria plus the archaea together, these two enormous groups that used to be the bacteria. And so I am going to not deal with that very much in these lectures, except as needed. I am going to continue to use bacteria in the older way, in the older sense, to encompass these two new enormous groups, the bacteria and the archaea. And every now and then, I will say I'm specifically talking about the archaea. Now, who are these archaea? Why are they so different? Why are we stumbling over the terminology? Why are we in such transition over the terminology for them? The archaea are also tiny, single-celled organisms, very, very bacteria-like, also lacking in much of any morphology at all. Also, you could represent these with tiny punctuation marks if you wanted to represent them. Also very intimate with the environment, also rapidly dividing. And so, of course, they were lumped together with the bacteria. It's only their DNA sequences that help people to realize that they were really a very different group. Their DNA sequences are really quite different. So a way to think about this, it's 4 billion years ago, two enormous groups of tiny featureless organisms began to diverge separately. And the archaea were almost in a sort of parallel universe with the bacteria. So while the bacteria were evolving all of their various fascinating things that they do with the environment, the archaea were also evolving their own versions of all of those intimate activities with the environment. So I think of it as a sort of a parallel universe. They have many bacterial-like properties, the archaea do, but I think some of that is partly because we human observers are looking for that sort of thing. And we say, okay, there they are, tiny, featureless, they're bacteria-like. based on their DNA and based on some of the things that they do in the environment, they really are a strikingly different group. So with that, I'm going to continue to misuse the word bacteria through most of these lectures in a colloquial way. I'm going to use it as sort of the old umbrella term for the two of them. And again, I'm just going to use the word archaea in particular circumstances where I think it could really help our understanding of things, especially when I talk about some of the really different things that the archaea are up to. In order to make the bacteria, and now I'm using it in that over umbrella generic way, in order to bring the bacteria into your nature studies, into anyone's nature studies, I need to make them seem accessible, in spite of their invisibility and in spite of their very, very different existence, so different that they're not even on a continuum with us, in spite of their aquatic existence, which is a challenge for us as terrestrial organisms. Here's how I think about it. They are hidden in plain sight, but they can be deciphered. And there are plenty of field microbiologists who can lead you to their favorite bacteria in the field. If you say, I'm looking for a sulfate reducer, they can say, aha, I know exactly where to find a sulfate reducing bacterium, and I know exactly what it's going to smell like and what it's going to look like, and I can lead you straight to that organism, and I can even pick up a little slimy bit of it and show it to you. So there are a huge collection of observations from nature by individual field microbiologists, and all we need to do is incorporate those. I call them rules of thumb for identifying bacteria in the field. So what I want to do right now is tell you some of my favorite rules of thumb for identifying bacteria in the field, and I want to begin that with a disclaimer. These are not rules of thumb that I have come up with by myself. These are coming from all of the specialists all over the world who have as their specialty field microbiology and who can lead you to their favorite bacteria in the field, who can pick up a bit of slime or scum and examine the color of it and examine the smell of it and the texture of it and tell you what bacteria they're holding or what is the majority of bacteria in that particular little bit of scum or slime or flock. So this is really the rules of thumb for field identification of bacteria gleaned from specialists from all different subspecialties of field microbiology, all put together and made to seem like rules of thumb. And one other disclaimer that I want to make about this is that I am going to mix together the concept of field marks and the concept of habitats in a way that might at first seem a little disconcerting, especially if you are a field guide user. And I'm going to take birds as an example of a typical field guide use. It's going to seem a little disconcerting at first if you are a field guide user that I'm not going to make a great difference between the habitat of a bacterium and a particular field mark. But I'm going to try to convince you otherwise, and I'm going to try to convince you that, in fact, users of field guides to birds will do this as well. And there is an acronym that ornithologists have used for years in which they have borrowed from the United States military that I'm going to evoke here, and that is JIZZ, J-I-Z-Z, and it comes from a military acronym. Actually, the acronym itself is G-I-S-S, but it's been converted for pronounceability to J-I-Z-Z, JIZZ. And as used by ornithologists, it refers to the total of all of the characteristics of a bird that can be seen briefly, perhaps, on the fly, along with its particular habitat, all put together as one sort of total holistic observation of that bird that allows you to make the field identification. Now, what was the U.S. military doing with this particular acronym? It stands for General Impression of Shape and Size, G-I-S-S, General Impression of Shape and Size. And it was used by plane spotters in World War II who were scanning the horizon trying to decide in a split second whether an incoming aircraft was an enemy aircraft or one of our aircrafts, presumably. And they were doing it on the basis of whatever sound they could hear, whatever color they could glimpse, even from far away, whatever shape they could see. And they were getting a general impression of it. Thus, general impression of shape and size converted to J-I-Z-Z for jizz. That's what ornithologists are doing. If you've ever been on a field trip with an ornithologist or a good bird watcher, you know that at no particular point do you have the bird in your hand, unless you're misnetting, but you're typically not netting birds and holding them in your hand. What you're typically doing is seeing a little fleeting glimpse, a flash of white, a particular way of flying, a particular way of getting into the underbrush, and in that complete picture, maybe a little squawk or a little sound, and that complete picture tells you what bird it is that you're seeing. That's the jizz of a bird. For example, if you saw a little flash of pink in a hedgerow at the edge of a field, and it was New England, and it was in the springtime, you might say, well, there's a male house finch. Okay. What you would not do is run through a list of all the pink birds in the world one at a time. Is it a flamingo? No. Is it a spoonbill? No. You would not do that exercise. You would immediately zero in on male house finch because you're not just looking at the field marks, you're also looking at the habitat. So I will contend that even in a regular field guide, field marks and habitat are mixed together in a way that doesn't typically get acknowledged, and that it matters very, very much where you are seeing the particular organism and the time of year that you're seeing the particular organism for you to narrow down the choice very precisely. Therefore, I'm not going to make much of a difference in these rules of thumb for field identifications of bacteria between field mark and habitat, especially since the subjects are so intimate with their environment, and environment is so important, and habitat is so important to who they are and what they're doing. And it's what they're doing that will allow us to identify them. So, that said, here are some of the rules of thumb. Look to extremes when you're looking for bacteria, and that's easier than you might think, because I mean extremes from our point of view, and we have a very limited range of habitat on Earth. For example, we can't go into the ocean. We're very superficial in our understanding of water. We understand the shoreline, we understand the surface waters, but we understand very, very little deep in the ocean. So pretty much anything aquatic is beyond our typical point of view. Pretty much anything deep into the surface of the earth, and we don't have to go too deep to be deep before we're beyond what we can really easily understand. Digging down into the soil, for example, and we're very, very quickly away from our typical point of view and into an extreme environment. Or even the black, smelly mud in the depths of a koi pond in the backyard, or in the depths of the compost heap that you might have in your backyard, could be considered extreme from our particular point of view. So it doesn't take much to go to an extreme environment. They're surrounding us all the time. Remember how superficial our own environment is on Earth. That would be my first recommendation for looking for bacteria. Look for places where larger organisms like ourselves cannot easily live. So I'm going to elaborate in later lectures on what you might be able to find in your compost heap, or what you might be able to find deep in your koi pond or goldfish pond, or what you might be able to find if you look in other extreme environments. And that will be one of the major features of some of the suggestions that I make in subsequent lectures. Second rule of thumb for looking for bacteria in the field is to see other organisms as surfaces for bacteria, or as containers for bacteria, essentially in some case fermentation vats for bacteria. And I'll also be giving you some suggestions about that as well in subsequent lectures about necessarily looking past other organisms in order to see the bacteria. And I'm also going to recommend as a third rule of thumb is to remember to use all of your senses. especially since bacteria are all about what they do and not necessarily about what they look like. So we're usually, if we're using an ordinary field guide to bacteria or if we're doing ordinary nature studies of things that are have morphologies and have various activities that we can identify, we're using our sense of sight quite a bit. In the case of bacteria, I like to bring out all five of my senses. I like to say I also want to smell what's going on in an environment. There are plenty of environments in which there are telltale smells of bacteria. I'm going to try to give you some examples of those in subsequent lectures. Touch. I'm not afraid to touch things. I'm going to try to convince you later that the vast majority of bacteria are not pathogens, and that if you're doing nature studies under normal circumstances, there is absolutely nothing wrong with touching a bit of slime or scum or flock, and there can be a lot of information in doing that. There are circumstances in which even taste could come into play. There are bacteria that are very much involved with making the great fermented cuisines of the world. And certainly you could go to a delicatessen or to a place that's making food in traditional manners and do some tasting and actually get field marks of bacteria that way. And even sense of hearing can be employed in the sense that many, many bacterial activities result in making bubbles, sort of an effervescent sound, and I'll try to give you some examples of that as well. And finally, I want to say something about these field marks in general, the sort of field marks that I'm going to try to put into subsequent lectures, the kind of field marks that I hope will make you recognize bacteria as being surprisingly accessible. I want to say that the ideas for these field marks are, for the most part, from what I could see from my research, not necessarily written down clearly in any particular places. I gathered them together and put them together into a field guide to bacteria, but they were really passed down in a sort of medieval guild style that is typical of academia, especially academia when folks are getting their higher degrees. Think about how medieval the gowns are that we put on at graduation. Strange medieval hats, the strange medieval gowns, the diplomas rolled up, sometimes written partly or entirely in Latin. There's a whole kind of medieval tradition there. And if you've ever gotten master's degree or PhD or some other advanced degree, you know also that you train under someone almost in a master to apprenticeship kind of relationship. And one of the things that I've noticed over the years is that when I have learned something about field identifications of bacteria, and when I see other people learning things about field identifications of bacteria, they tend to be passed down almost as though they were guild secrets, medieval guild secrets, so that it's a word of mouth thing. It's part of the training of someone who is going to be a PhD in field microbiology, but not necessarily what they're going to officially write down. I don't know quite why that is, but a lot of what I've tried to collect together about this topic and to present really is being passed down in that particular way. And therefore, I think bacteria continue to have that inaccessible feel to them, because if you read about them, they continue to seem tiny and featureless and not necessarily something that you could simply walk out into the environment and take a look at. Now, in the next couple of lectures, I want to turn to the history of microbiology. I want to turn to the deep history of microbiology at first, all the way back to the 17th century, and then on into the 19th century and the early 20th century to really set the scene for how our understanding of bacteria has come about. And this might be a good point also for me to say something about microorganisms versus bacteria. When people first began to use microscopes, they were looking at microorganisms and not making any particular distinction between one or another group. It was all amazing. It was all tiny, and it all required microscopes. And microorganism continues to be a good general way to talk about things that are tiny, things that we see under the microscope. that can be shortened to microbes also, and I sometimes use those interchangeably, microbes or microorganisms. The more that was understood about microorganisms and microbes, the more it was realized that there was different types of them. So think of bacteria and think of archaea, and now I'm using bacteria and archaea separately as those two sort of parallel universe groups of tiny organisms. Think of bacteria and archaea as types of microorganisms or types of microbes, but also think of certain tiny fungi and protozoans or protists as also other types of microorganisms. So there's a huge world of microorganisms, and we're only really touching on one particular aspect of that, the world of the bacteria and the world of the archaea. But the early microscopists, and I'm going to begin with Anton van Leeuwenhoek in the next lecture, were looking at microorganisms. They did not make serious differentiations between bacteria and between the others that are actually a little larger than the bacteria. I will try to make that clear in particular places in these lectures coming up, especially where it's important and where I want to distinguish the microbial world in that way.
This ends Lecture 2. If you borrow this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399, and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.